Welcome to the Brave Little Podcast, coming from Dallas, Texas and Sacramento, California. Here's Skylar Teo and David Stauffer.
Welcome to the Brave Little Podcast from Los Angeles, California, per usual. Aaron Alvarado, how you doing?
Hey, David, how you doing, buddy? It's good to be back. It's been so long.
Good to be back. Yeah.
Got to knock off these cobwebs.
I've been knocking off those documentaries you recommended from the last episode.
Good. That is good to hear.
Yeah.
Did you like
Digging
any
American
of them?
Movie.
Oh, yeah. Did you like American Movie? Yes. Good. That's good to hear.
I haven't finished it. I admittedly haven't finished it, but so far what I've seen, I really love.
Does that mean you just watched the trailer? Is that what you're trying to tell me?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
By having finished it, meaning I've got it loaded up on Crackle. It's in the queue.
I promise you might like it. So there.
Okay.
I'm going to go out on a limb. You might enjoy it.
Well, I love everything that comes out of Wisconsin. So, all right, we're going to get right into this because we've got a lot of Coen brothers to talk about. But Hail Caesar is a movie that I've been talking about quite a bit. Mostly because it's a movie that came out in February, which is the place that studios release films that they don't believe in. And when we started getting trailers for Hail Caesar at the end of 2015, they were amazing trailers. It was exciting. And then all of a sudden, this idea of releasing it on February 8th was so bizarre because if you can release a movie in early February, you could have easily done a limited release at the end of December and had it up for awards consideration.
Right,
so
exactly.
So the fact the studio is releasing this wide, limited or wide, in February, meant the studio did not believe in the financial success of this film, like, at all. And that turned out to be true. They did not believe in that this film was going to make any money.
Oh, no. That was a good call on that end.
Well, yes. As we've seen, it was the worst opening ever for Coen Brothers.
Oof.
I think that's what it was. Or
yeah,
the worst
yeah,
opening
I read
since.
That.
Yeah. Yeah. So I've had low expectations going in because, like, it's insane to me with this cast and the fact that it's the Coen Brothers, who, by the way, are already nominated for an Academy Award. For this upcoming awards, they wrote the film Bridge of Spies, which got nominated
for a
screenplay.
I did not know that.
Yeah, yeah. They wrote the screenplay for a Spielberg film, which is which I love. I didn't love Unbroken, which they also wrote the screenplay for, that Angelina Jolie
yeah,
directorial
right.
debut.
I missed that one.
Did you see that?
No, I missed
okay.
it. Was that the Prisoner of War one, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's yeah. 3/4 of the film, he's getting tortured in a Japanese prison camp, and I frankly don't think the Japanese are all that bad. So
you may be a little biased there, but
no. Anyway, so what I'm getting at is I approached this movie with fairly low expectations, and
same here.
I was delightfully surprised. I really, really, really liked this film. What did you think?
I liked it a lot. I thought, like you, I had very low expectations. And, it takes a minute to kind of kick in. It kind of starts slowly. But, you know, as I gave it time, as I kind of just checked my reservations at the door and just kind of gave myself over to it, it was really entertaining. I mean, it's very funny. It's one of the funnier Coen Brothers movies, I think. And it's if you're a film lover, if you love any of the history of Hollywood, this is the movie for you. And I feel like this was a love letter to old style Hollywood. Clearly, the Coen Brothers were infatuated with that old sort of studio system movies, and this was a really nice. It was really cool to see them take it on and kind of update a little bit, obviously with their newer techniques and whatnot, but. It's just an overall really entertaining movie. So I was very happy with it by the end of it.
Yeah, the Coens make, their filmography is incredibly varied from the level of silliness to seriousness to whatever, you know, and trying to figure out what movie this was going to kind of be, like where it was going to fall.
Yeah.
it certainly was on the more lighthearted side. Right. But I would say that there's actually quite a bit going on beneath the surface. I think it's like deceptively lighthearted in the sense that I think there's two parallel like themes and story, like things that are going on with this film. And both things I really, really loved.
Yeah.
And one of those is it's simultaneously celebrating and paying homage to the golden age and the golden era of Hollywood, while also lampooning it at the same time.
Right.
And almost taking the viewer on a tour of what that was like. So much so that you're literally taking a tour through the studio lot to random scenes and sequences of different films, whether it's like this prestige picture being directed by Ralph Fiennes or this musical with Channing Tatum. Mm-hmm.
The biblical epic.
And maybe this is a biblical epic, which is the namesake of the film.
Right.
And you've got, I mean, I guess that's one area that, while I loved it, I think this is it. Maybe some of the criticism leveled at the film is due to the fact that the Coens take their time in these scenes. Like, the Channing Tatum musical number is not a short one. It shows us the whole thing. And it doesn't really serve the purpose of the overall narrative, per se, but it's a heck of a lot of fun, and it's hilarious.
It really is. And, you know, one of the early reviews I read talked about that, and it talked about how there was a dance sequence, there was a there was one of those water ballet sequences. And reading that, I actually started to dread watching the movie because I cannot stand those. I can't watch those old movies like that. It just does absolutely nothing for me. But I hate musical theater too, so that's just my thing. But watching it in the moment, it totally works. I love that they did it. It was really fun. It was just a nice little, just a kind of like a little bit of a timeout from the rest of the plot that's moving forward. You kind of just get this pause and check out what they did before. Like, it's kind of a fun little thing they do there.
So, by the way, shout out to Luke Hawkins from Folsom, California, a guy I went to high school with, one of the dancers in that sequence.
Oh, wow.
One of the tap dancers on the
That's
table.
Incredible.
Yeah. Yeah, he's been posting on his Facebook.
Was he the guy grinding up against Channing Tatum?
I knew you were going to ask that. I badly wanted him to be, but no, he was not. He had been posting on Facebook about being involved in this Coen Brothers film, and I know he lives in New York City now, and he teaches dance classes, and he's like this expert dancer, and so I wondered if he was helping out with the choreography or something, but no, he's legitimately one of the sailors, and he's like
Very
featured
cool.
prominently in it. He's not just a background guy; he's like one of the main guys right next to Channing Tatum. So watching the film was a little bit surreal. I was like, oh, there's Luke. Whoa, Luke is in a Coen Brothers film next to Channing Tatum. This is crazy.
Yeah.
Gotta try to get him on the pod. Actually, would be cool. Because I want to
tap dance in his episode. Just put a microphone next to his feet and have him tap dance.
I kind of want to know what the Coen Brothers are like.
Right.
Directing a sequence like that. I don't know. It'd be cool, but maybe we'll try and get him. But anyway. But you're right. We take these detours, which are so much fun because you get that musical number. You get, as I mentioned, that Ralph Fiennes one of my favorite scenes in the film is one that's been
excellent.
Used a lot in the. It's so good.
Yeah.
It's been used a lot in the marketing, but the would that it were so simple scene is so good.
I had no idea that scene was in there. I tried not to watch any of the trailers or anything. So when that scene happened, I'm dying. I'm cracking up, and no one else in the theater is laughing, I guess, because they've already seen it. But I thought that was hilarious.
Yeah. There was a whole trailer that was built around just that scene over and over and over and over again, which is a shame because it's better experienced how you did, right?
Yeah.
Like not knowing. And for those that don't know what I'm talking about, it's not a huge spoiler. Don't watch trailers if you've been able to avoid them thus far. But essentially, there is this this kind of this rising star that's in these Western films. Hobie Doyle is his name, which is such a great name.
It really is. I love the character names used.
He's also one of the most earnest characters in the film. In the sense that, like, you know, he's just this really nice Southern drawl kid that that is becoming popular. So they try to put him in this prestige picture that's being directed by Ralph Fiennes, who plays the part so well of this director that's trying to keep this thing, you know, all kids, this production together. And there's this line in the film that's, "Oh, would that it were so simple." And the kid with the Southern drawl really can't say it in the exact way that Ralph Fiennes wants him to. And so he asks him to, you know, essentially imitate or mimic the way he's saying it as he's directing him. And it results in them saying it probably 100 times back and forth. And it's hilarious.
It's very funny. And, you know, just like thinking about the movie, that's the scene that stands out for me. And I will still just start laughing thinking about it because it's so funny.
Yeah, yeah,
that actor that played Hobie Doyle, I've never seen him before.
Yeah.
I guess his name is Alden Ehrenreich or something like that. Okay. I've never seen him before, but he was so good in that Hobie Doyle role. He was probably my favorite part of the movie, to be honest with you, because like you said, he was so earnest. What you saw is what you get. He was just a really cool little character, and I thought that actor's solid, super solid performance by him.
No, he was great, and I'm pretty sure this was his first big picture, and like he was featured fairly prominently, which is funny to me when I see the poster, and I get it from a marketing perspective. But on the poster, they have like 5 photos.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, like the leftmost photo is Channing Tatum,
uh-huh.
who is, you know, not in this movie a ton.
No.
Then it has Scarlett Johansson, also not in this movie a ton.
No.
It has Josh Brolin in the middle, the main character.
Yeah.
Okay. And then it has Jonah Hill, who is in this film for 20 seconds.
So. If that, I mean, is the, okay, so the one trailer I did see was a commercial, and I saw it a couple times, and it basically has all of Jonah Hill's part in it.
Yes.
So
yes.
It's like,
if you've, yes.
that's all he does in the movie is what you saw in the commercial.
Yeah.
So
for those of you who have seen the trailers, that's all of Jonah Hill.
That's it. That's it.
But
I mean,
he makes the poster. Meanwhile, Alden Ehrenreich, whatever his name is.
Yeah,
I love that. I'm trying to give the guy credit and I don't even know his name. He's in the movie more than everyone on the cover except Josh Brolin. I mean, even Tilda Swinton should have been on the front.
Definitely.
She plays 2 characters.
Yep.
For goodness sakes. So, so it really fascinating. But you're right. I really liked his Hobie Doyle character. I thought it was really great. His lassoing on the street while he's waiting for his studio setup date.
I loved his introduction. Like, you saw him on the set of a Western and he's doing some trick writing. It's so funny just to see him pull it off.
So that's one part or theme or purpose of this film is showing us all these different genres, the golden age, whatever. And then there's this other theme that's going on, which is focused more on Josh Brolin's character, who plays Eddie Mannix, who's a studio executive that's essentially a fixer.
Yeah.
That is trying to keep everything together, any problem that exists. And he's in almost every frame of this film. I mean, he's mm-hmm. you know, the dominant character here. But what's going on here is what I view, and, you know, someone that is a religious person and grew up with a religious background, becomes clear to me that there's a clear religious kind of allegory here. And what it is that they're making a movie about Christ called Hail Caesar. You know, it takes place in the times of Christ. So that's obvious. But Josh Brolin's character, the movie opens up with him in a confessional booth. It also ends with him in a confessional booth, in a funny scene where the priest, the Catholic priest, essentially says, "You confess too often. You're really not that bad." but Josh Brolin's character is a Christ figure in this film, in the sense that he's taking on essentially all of the sins of everything that's going on with all the different studio productions, whether Scarlett Johansson's character is getting pregnant out of wedlock, whether Baird Whitlock, the George Clooney character, gets kidnapped and is missing, and he has to arrange the ransom money with this group called The Future, which is hilarious. I love so much the story thread about who kidnaps George Clooney and why.
We agreed
beforehand not to reveal that.
It's good to go in that blind. It's great. You know, it's very interesting that you brought up the Christ-like figure that he is. I didn't even really think about that, but now that you mention it, I think you're totally right. And not only all those things that you mentioned, but how about the fact that he had temptation from the head of Lockerbie or something?
Lockheed.
I don't know. Yeah, Lockheed Martin. Right. So that's his temptation. This job offer to move on to something much easier. He would have been paid a lot more, and it's an offer that's on the table. So
that's
interesting.
So you're exactly right. So you got Lockheed Martin that's trying to tempt him with a much better job offer that's easier, more money, and yet it would be literally destroying things, destruction. Yeah. Like part of the guy's pitch is showing him like the A-bomb, like this is what we do. and then this idea that Josh Brolin, and he communicates this several times throughout the film, that he's this theme that the pictures have worth, and he says that more than once, that the pictures actually have worth. And he really believes, he has this idealistic viewpoint that motion pictures actually matter. And he's willing to do whatever it takes to keep everything together, to keep the perception that the movie stars are pure, innocent, good people, that the films are able to get made, in the budget that they're supposed to, on the timeline that they're supposed to. And so he's going through trying to do these things. Meanwhile, you have other random religious tidbits, like one of my favorite scenes, which was him getting a bunch of ecclesiastical leaders together to figure out if, in his words, if the portrayal of Christ Jesus cuts the mustard in Hail Caesar. And he gets an Eastern Orthodox patriarch, a Catholic priest, like a Protestant minister, and a Jewish rabbi in a room to go, have them read the script and see if there's anything offensive. And the first thing that's brought up by the Eastern Orthodox patriarch is, what was offensive to him is that one guy jumping from one chariot to the other didn't seem very realistic. which is my favorite. And then, of course, a debate ensues about the nature of deity and about God, or is God the Son or whatever.
Yeah,
and,
right.
You know, that's something that, I'm certainly all too familiar with. It's really quite funny. And ultimately, they're just apathetic to, they don't really care.
Right. As long as he's not embarrassing, I think that's what they're going for.
Yes. And then at the very end of the film, one of the funnier parts, but also poignant, I think it actually ties back into some of the religious themes, is the three crosses. You have the three people up on the crucifix with the crucifixion scene. And in between takes, there's just some studio aide or whatever assistant that's going up to the three actors that are up on the crosses. And you don't even see their faces. You just see their feet. And it's focusing on the studio guy. And he's asking them if that morning if they had a box breakfast or a hot breakfast. And the guy that's playing Jesus is like, what? And he's like, are you an extra or are you a principal? And the guy's like, principal, I guess. Like, he's really unsure, and it's hilarious because you could read into that any number of things, whether that's the hypocrisy of maybe even Christians that preach the Bible but don't put Jesus Christ as like the principal, right? Like that aren't actually focusing on what he taught, and that's one thing I took out of it. People could actually read that scene for any number of ways.
Sure.
It could also be just straight comedy.
Yeah, exactly.
But like that's the beauty of the Coens, is they want us to be able to do that, to be able to get any number of things, because they're famously cagey about talking about what scenes or what their movies actually mean. Like, they don't answer those questions.
Yeah, with good reason. I don't think a good writer needs to answer those questions. Really, it is what it is. I hate that saying, but it's true.
Yeah.
So I think another not criticism, but kind of I've heard people talk about the movie how it's a send up of a critique of capitalism in general, because you're talking about a studio head. Who's possibly being replaced, and it's a whole studio system where it's all about churning out pictures. It's not about art, but you do have the one figure, the Eddie Mannix figure, who does care about the art, and he might be the last of a dying breed. So it's pretty interesting to look at it from that angle too. Technically, I think if we can just talk about for a second the look of the movie, I mean, it's gorgeous. It's absolutely stunning.
Yes.
Of course, Roger Deakins, longtime Coen Brothers collaborator.
Yes.
Deakins has famously talked about how he's basically done shooting on film, but the Coens insist on it. So this movie was shot on film.
Yeah.
And it really shines. I mean, it's one of the more beautiful pictures I've seen in a very long time. It's just gorgeous to look at. It has that... the quality of an older classic 50s Hollywood movie. the post-processing that makes it look that way. And it's just really fun to look at. And if you ever hear the Coens talk about the whole process to shoot some of the sequences, like the choreographed swimming scene or the diving scene, they talk about how difficult it is. And they really don't know how the old filmmakers shot those, because there's no instructions. Like, there's no behind the scenes or no instruction on how to shoot this stuff. So they actually talk about reverse engineering it, basically. So they just figured out how they can do it, and it might not necessarily be how it was originally done. They just don't even have those processes anymore. So it's pretty interesting to talk about, to look into the technical aspects of the film too.
Yeah, well, when it comes to technical stuff, the Coens, that's always where they shine. If you look at their whole filmography, there's only one film that I honestly don't really like. Now, some of them I haven't finished. I've started at least all of them. But there's only one that I don't really like.
Are you talking about Llewyn Davis?
Yeah, right. No, we're going to talk about Llewyn Davis. The Lady Killers is the one I don't like. But yeah. Even then, yeah. Their films will be beautifully shot. From a technical standpoint, they will be nearly perfect almost every time. I mean, that they just are so good. And a lot of that has to do with Deakins, who you know they largely collaborate with. They've had a few other cinematographers, but Deakins is their main guy. And he's so good.
He's probably one of the two or three best in the world. So, yeah, it shows every time. So. And I heard them talk about this specific shoot, and basically they're so familiar with Deakins at this point, they don't even have to tell him what to do. It's basically he can read their minds. So that's a really interesting collaboration there. They're so comfortable with each other that they know exactly what they need. It's really cool to watch play out. So,
well, I hope that our praise has been effusive enough. This film has made very little money. Very few people have gone and seen it, and so
very unfortunate.
Now the Coen brothers usually make their films on like a pretty modest budget. Like 20 to 30 million is a common number for their production budget. I don't recall what this one is exactly. So I don't know if it'll necessarily lose money, but it's their lowest opening ever. So if anything, please go see this film. Enjoy this film. It's not going to be a traditional narrative film like you expect. It's going to lampoon both left and right ideologies. It'll lampoon and semi-celebrate religion. It's going to do a whole lot of things, and it might confuse you a little bit, but take out of it what you will and enjoy the ride. I think this movie is absolutely worth the ticket price. Yeah. Go see it.
100% agree. So, well, very well said.
So let's launch into our top five Coen Brothers films. They've made 17 films, 18 films, something like that. Starting in 1984, I believe, with Blood Simple, and then most recently with Hail Caesar. I didn't consider Hail Caesar for my top five because I like to. I always like let movies kind of ferment and sit and have rewatch them because. Every film on my top five I've seen more than once, and so I think that's a necessary thing. Now, cutting the top five of Coen Brothers is really, really interesting. And while going through that, there were a lot of films that I hadn't seen, and so I at least started them. And if I felt like that they had a chance of cracking my top five, I would sit through and watch it all. Some of them I didn't, but I at least tempted to watch all the Coen Brothers film. And I have a five that I'm comfortable with. Even though there are a few left off that I was surprised about, but before we go into our five, Skylar and I did a Mount Rushmore of filmmakers, early on in recording this podcast, and I had my four, and I was surprised that I left off the Coen brothers at the time, and my four were Christopher Nolan, Quentin Tarantino, David Fincher, and Wes Anderson, and Skylar and I only differed on one. I had David Fincher, where he had, I think it was either Ben Affleck or the Shaun of the Dead guy. I'm forgetting his name. Edward.
Yeah. I can't think of his
Edward
name
Wright.
Yes.
Edgar Wright. Sorry.
Edgar Wright. Yeah.
So both I think have made too few movies for me to put him up there, but I actually think I'm going to change my Mount Rushmore.
Yeah,
because I couldn't handle it going through these Coen Brothers films. I think I take Wes Anderson off and I put the Coen Brothers on for now. As much as I love Wes Anderson,
I would agree with that. The Coen Brothers
have made too many good movies. Too many. Now, Wes Anderson might be able to go up and etch his spot again, but he, like, the filmography, just comparing the two, it's like, oh, the Coen brothers have made too many good movies. And so I'm putting the Coen brothers on instead of Wes Anderson.
Yeah,
so
I think that's a good choice. That's a good choice.
There's my amendment. But let's launch into these. If you want to start us off, what's your number 5?
Yeah, sure thing. So for me, the Coen brothers, they have, in my mind, they have a top four that I couldn't see any movie breaking into that top four. So for number 5, I had about four or five choices to really slot in there. And the one that I ended up picking is Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Okay.
So this is a movie that I literally watched four times before I decided to actually like it. So I tried to watch it four different times, and each time I just shut it off and said, I don't understand. Why does this movie get so much praise? It just doesn't make sense to me. And on the fifth watching, I said, I'm going to watch this all the way through, and it totally worked. Everything about it, just for some reason on that day, everything clicked for me. And for anyone that doesn't know, it's Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? It's a kind of a musical, really. It's set in Mississippi during the 1930s, around three escaped convicts, and they're searching for this hidden treasure while being hunted down by the lawmen. And it's very loose adaptation of the Odyssey by Homer. And all the meanwhile, it's these there's another subplot where these guys end up making a record. And
the Soggy Bottom Boys.
Yes, the Soggy Bottom Boys. And the record becomes a gigantic hit across the South, across the entire nation, actually. And so that's kind of the subplot that it's intertwined in there. And so this movie, it's really well made, obviously well written, very interesting characters. Clooney, he shines as the main character. The music is fantastic. The music is so good. Yeah. And it's really,
T-Bone Burnett.
Oh, man. And that's he's collaborated with Coen. He's collaborated with the Coens before, and it works every time. Yeah. So for Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? It's a movie that I didn't like at first, but now I would say it's definitely in the top five for me.
So my number 5 is Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
good choice.
So, you just named a lot of terrific reasons. John Turturro is also terrific in it. The whole cast is really great. Yeah. It's really, it's bona fide is, I think, the best way to put it.
Are you a Dapper Dan man?
Look, this is funny because this was a big deal when it came out.
Huge.
I remember I was like a freshman in high school, I think, when it came out, and people loved this film, and I remember
white
not getting it
love
at
this
first.
Film.
What's
Let's
that?
Be honest. Let's be honest. White people love this film.
Yeah. Not just white people. White Mormons love this film. Which is funny that we mentioned that because in the Netflix documentary about Mitt Romney, there is a scene where he's getting his hair cut or something like that, like on the campaign trail, and he's chatting with the hairstylist, and he quotes, "Oh brother, where art thou?"
Oh, wow.
And she asks it's something effective, and I don't remember exactly what happens, but she asks where that's from, and he mentions, "Oh brother, where art thou?" And she says she hasn't seen it. And he's like, "We haven't seen Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? It's great." And he goes on, like, just that little bit in the film ended up making headlines on like entertainment sites. That's like, "Oh, Mitt Romney likes fine art." Like, who would have known Mitt Romney likes a Coen Brothers film? How is that even possible? I love this, the liberal sites that like can't even fathom that some like a Republican could possibly like a Coen Brothers film,
that
which
is
hilarious
funny.
To me.
Yeah.
And so.
One of the underrated things about the Coens is they are independent filmmakers first and foremost. They're probably one of the directors or directing teams, if you will, that transcended the independent label. They got their start in the 80s and they blossomed. They're huge. Their movies, like you said, are done cheaply, and kind of some of them are outside the studio system. So I mean, they're independent. Really, they're independent filmmakers. So to their core. And, I mean, this movie, who would make this movie in a studio? Think about that.
Oh, there's no way. Oh, yeah, there's no way. It's such a good movie, though. Yeah. And it, like, to your point, though, it required multiple viewings for me, too, to fully embrace and enjoy it. Because when everyone was loving it around me when it came out, I remember thinking, like, I don't get it. I don't even understand half the words they're saying.
Right.
It took some time for me to fully embrace it, and now I totally do. So number five is the same for me. So I'm gonna jump to my four then.
Yeah, go for it. Go for it.
Number four is one that I feel like is kind of like there. If anything has permeated pop culture in terms of those films, it's gonna be this one. It's The Big Lebowski.
Can I just say The Big Lebowski is my number four too?
Gosh dang it. I knew this was going to happen.
So please, let's hear it.
I knew it. Oh, gosh. Okay, well.
So tell me what you love about The Lebowski.
If you're listening to this, if you haven't seen The Big Lebowski, go see it. It's a great film. It's got John Goodman, or as I like to say, John Greatman.
He's great when he works with the Coens, honestly. When he works for the Coens, he is so much better than when he's in anything else.
No, it's the best. John, they know exactly how to use John Goodman.
Perfectly.
And whether it's in a smaller role or in Big Lebowski, a much bigger one, or even in Barton Fink, a little bit of a bigger one. And he was great. And anyway, the Big Lebowski, there's many memes that have come out of this. There have been many. It's very quotable. It's Jeff Bridges, the dude, and it's a very, very loose film that just kind of takes you on a ride. You don't know exactly where you're going, and it's definitely one of the most rewatchable, maybe their most rewatchable film. It's certainly lighthearted. It knows what it is, and it has a whole lot of fun, but I don't think I need to say a whole lot more about The Big Lebowski. I think most people probably have seen it.
Yeah, I think that this is the one movie that probably most people are familiar with. Maybe Fargo as well, but Lebowski, it's such a good movie. It's the funniest movie that I think they've made. Like you said, it's very rewatchable, and for some reason it just caught on. Yeah. I think it was – I don't know if it did big box office. I think that it was more like a home video, home DVD type of movie that really just caught on as a cult hit. But yeah, it's so funny.
Philip Seymour Hoffman.
He's great. He is great in his role. Yeah. So Philip Seymour Hoffman, Steve Buscemi, John Turturro plays a very memorable. Here's the thing about the Coens.
Yes.
Their characters have these lines of dialogue that are so memorable that you come back to them. And it's like if someone in the real world quotes this.
Well, that's just like your opinion, man.
Exactly. So you can't escape it. And this is the movie that has the most quotable lines, I think.
Yeah, totally. So, dude, I'm afraid to ask, but what's your number three?
So for number three, I have No Country for Old Men.
Oh, okay, cool. Right. So we differ here.
Good. So for anyone that doesn't know about No Country, did it win Best Picture in 2007? Best
Picture did. Oscar. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Obviously, one of their most decorated films as far as critical acclaim goes. It's the story is a Vietnam vet, Llewellyn Moss is his name, played by Josh Brolin, discovers there's the remnants of a drug deal gone horribly wrong while hunting in rural Texas. Llewellyn decides to take the money and basically run. So the problem is once he takes that money, there's an unrelenting psychopath killing machine charged with finding that money and taking it back to his boss. So, and that's played that, he's played by, Javier Bardem. So, Bardem is fantastic in this movie. He's so scary. I would say that No Country for Old Men is actually a horror film. Bardem plays like the Michael Myers or Freddy Krueger type of character that is just unrelenting, solely focused on getting revenge or accomplishing his goal. Nothing will stand in his way. He's unstoppable. He's unkillable. And I think that he's been compared to the devil. I think the Coens have said that he is actually supposed to be the embodiment of the devil. Maybe – I don't know if they said it or someone said it. But
That's been an oft –
So, I think that he also represents fate or destiny.
Mm-hmm.
So you can run from destiny, but eventually it's going to catch up with you. And that's kind of what I took from the movie. Overall, it's just a fantastic picture. It was definitely, you know, it was up there with There Will Be Blood as my two favorite movies from 2007. And both of those movies are just absolute classics. So that's number three for me. No Country for Old Men.
Okay. So my number three is Fargo.
Solid choice.
Fargo's. I've got a feeling we're going to hear about it coming up from you as well. One of the four you talk about that you can't leave off the list. Fargo is a great film, like top to bottom. And it's the we talk about the Coens going really silly. We talk about the Coens going really serious. No Country for Old Men has no ounce of silliness in it. Right? It's totally serious. Fargo is the perfect balance of taking something really serious and really silly and making crafting this dark comedy about these people that are kind of like, aw shucks, have got this accent, and these horrible things are happening. And there's a juxtaposition there that you're having to deal with in the film that make for very memorable scenes, very funny scenes, very horrifying scenes. And it's one of my favorite William H. Macy role in the film. He's so good in this film.
Yeah, he's excellent.
I remember the first time I saw Fargo, I remember like I didn't know what to think. It was nominated for Best Picture. It's certainly celebrated as one of their greatest films. And it's oddly enough has spawned a TV show that nearly matches the movie quality in terms of TV quality. Like it's one of the greatest TV shows on television right now. So the second season was the best episode, was the best season of television in 2015.
Oh, by far. Yeah.
And this is one of the best movies that come out, and one of their best movies ever. And so it's so weird to see that. And now the Coens play certainly much less role in the TV show. They're executive producers, but Noah Hawley, I believe, is the brains behind the TV show. And so I'd like to think the Coens have something to do with the greatness of the TV show as well.
I think it's just being around them. Number three.
Yeah, seriously, just breathing their same air.
Yeah. So number three, I have Fargo as number two on my list.
Okay. So and No Country for Old Men is number two on mine.
Well, there you go. One last thing about No Country for Old Men. I recently rewatched it, and I don't remember if there's a score in that movie. Maybe there are some scenes with music, but I can't remember very much music being used at all. And it just makes it more haunting, in my opinion. Yeah. So that's another reason why I think it's a horror film. Just kind of so desolate sounding.
After you get done talking about Fargo, I'm going to get on to No Country.
Yes, can't wait. So going back to Fargo, it's my favorite dark comedy of all time. It's so well written. Yeah. The characters are so interesting and complex. Jerry Lundegaard, like you said, played by William H. Macy. He is maybe the greatest loser in movie history.
Yeah. Yes.
Everything he touches just falls apart, and it's so perfect. And William H. Macy has that face where it's just like, oh, you feel so bad for him. Yeah. He has a look in his eyes. He just pulls it off masterfully. So that's a great, great film. Very funny, very dark. One of the greatest scenes ever is the wood chipper scene. Very iconic scene. So many great lines in that movie. That's another one that's so quotable. I mean, oh, man. Just Fargo is definitely probably one of my top 10 movies of all time. So.
Oh, it's great. It really is great. No Country for Old Men is my number two, as I mentioned.
Yes.
No Country for Old Men came out, at the end of, it came out in 2007. I was on my mission in Illinois at the time, so I was not allowed to see films. But I came home when it was right after the Oscars, I think. But it was in the middle of the debate of There Will Be Blood versus No Country for Old Men, which you alluded to earlier. And it was amazing because, you know, I get home and I've got 2 years of movies that I need to catch up on. And which included things like Spider-Man 3 and and Superman Returns. But my friends, you know, you included, I was asking about current cinema, and everyone said There Will Be Blood versus No Country for Old Men. There are two camps of people. And so I view both films, and upon initial viewing of both of them, to me, I immediately gravitated towards No Country for Old Men. I love both films, and it took me a little while to appreciate There Will Be Blood.
Really? That's
and
surprising.
Both films, both films. See, There Will Be Blood was incredible performance, incredible performance from Daniel Day-Lewis. I felt like the ending, it just completely fell apart at the time. Now, I've appreciated the ending a little bit more. Good. The funny thing is I grappled and had issues with both endings of these films. You mentioned No Country for Old Men being this horror film, right? In horror films, we usually get what we want at the end. Right. And even though we want the good, we kind of want the good guy to win, but we don't. Like we want Michael Myers to stand back exactly. up after he was seemingly dead, and for it to end that way. But No Country for Old Men, you're watching a film that has a chase scene, and you're waiting for this climactic scene, this buildup of the demise of one of these characters, and it happens off screen. Which felt so underwhelming at the mm-hmm. time. Now, brilliant in retrospect. I actually think it's brilliant that we oh, yeah. did not get what we wanted.
Definitely agree.
But when I first watched it, I was like, oh, you're kidding. Did everything just happen while we were hanging out with Tommy yeah. Lee Jones?
Right, exactly. You know, like, well, you know, it just makes it feel like he's so inconsequential. So it was yeah. perfect. It was
yeah,
so
it
great.
Was, oh, absolutely perfect. Yeah. But at the time, yeah. At the time, I really, really struggled with it. and then There Will Be Blood had an ending that, like, for me, it just didn't totally jive. I've appreciated it more. I still think the ending, now that I've revisited both films many times, the ending okay. of No Country for Old Men, to me, in retrospect, I think is more brilliant in the way it was done. Mm. I still love There Will Be Blood. I think it's masterful work. But No Country for Old Men, from a technical standpoint, is a perfect film. And you've got Javier Bardem in this incredible tour de force performance as Sugar or whatever his name is.
Yeah.
That's just this such a good bad guy. And then these small little roles from Woody Harrelson and Tommy Lee Jones that are really, really good. And then Josh Brolin, who has sneakily become the most underrated actor of this generation. I honestly think he doesn't get enough love. And to go back to Hail Caesar, which he was amazing in.
Fantastic.
Yeah, just doesn't get enough love.
No, Brolin was definitely the glue in Hail Caesar, and he was the sun, and everyone was revolving around him, and he was perfect in it. No Country for Old Men, he was also very good. I feel like he didn't have a lot of big parts before this, and I think they talked about this recently, or he talked about this recently, how he said that he auditioned for the part, and he felt like he gave. He put it all on the line. He went all out, got help to do it. And I can't remember which one of the Coen brothers saw it, but they said, oh, that's pretty good. Now, can you do it with a Texas accent? And yeah. and he said, yes, I sure can. Even though he felt like he was doing it with the Texas accent.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
So I guess that fell a little flat. But his performance in the movie in No Country for Old Men was fantastic. I mean, it's...
Yeah,
he pulls it off really, really well. I'm really grateful that he nailed it in this one because, like you said, he's built off of it, and now he's one of the most dependable actors working in Hollywood. So,
yeah, So, I really, really love No Country for Old Men. It's it's my number two. But you and I don't think we have the same number one.
We sure don't. We definitely do not.
But I got to know, what's your number one?
So my number one, this is a movie that I come back to very frequently. Anytime someone asks me about the Coen brothers, this is the movie that I mention first because I feel like it's so masterfully done. And that's Miller's Crossing. Crossing is a gangster film set in the 1930s. And, you know, it's not as critically acclaimed as other gangster films, but I feel like it is genre defining. It stands up there with The Godfathers and Goodfellas as kind of the pinnacle of what you want to achieve in a gangster film. I mean, it has all the prerequisites. It's it's got a ruthless mob boss, it has crooked cops, double crossing underlings, fast women, Tommy guns, and super witty dialogue. And so this movie, I feel like it's the most fleshed out universe that the Coens created. The characters, the settings, the interactions, they all feel so authentic. And it's you look at the scenes and you feel like, man, where's this place? When did this happen? And it's nowhere. Like, this isn't Chicago. This isn't New York. It's just some random city that they created. But it feels like this is a real place. And it feels like you could look these characters up in an encyclopedia and read about them, but they're not real. I mean, they're fake. But that just goes to show how fully developed they were. And I thought the Coen brothers just... They just knocked it out of the park with this movie. And some of the acting performances, I mean, John Turturro as the Bernie character, I mean, he is unreal. His performance is so good. there's a scene where in the woods and he's begging for his life, and his performance, I mean, it's something to behold. And I don't know if anyone's ever acted better than he does in that one scene. And Gabriel Byrne as Tom, he's so strong in that role. Man, Gabriel Byrne is an awesome, awesome actor. But yeah, you have Albert Finney, and you have some just really, really great parts. So Miller's Crossing, that's my number one favorite all-time Coen Brothers film.
So we do not have the same number one.
Good. At least we can disagree on something.
Yeah. Well, so Miller's Crossing was one I had not seen until preparing for this pod. And I did watch it all. I did love it. But I have to spend more time with it
You do.
Yeah. Had I grown up with it or kept watching it, it came out, what, 91 or something?
It's pretty early. It's pretty early on. I think it was their third film. Okay. So, yeah, it's beautifully shot. Everything about it is just so gorgeous, man. But also,
I like that.
On top of all that, it's a surreal movie. Like, there are moments that are surreal, and that's like a trademark of the Coen Brothers, especially the violent scenes, the scenes where there's like shootings. It's kind of ridiculous. Like, some of the machine gun scenes, it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of funny to watch. But that's the trademark of the Coens. Like, they like to kind of let the viewer know that he's still watching a movie or she's watching a movie still. So that's kind of fun too. Something to look out for. But yeah, definitely take the time and watch this movie again, because it gets better the more times you watch it.
Good. Good. No, I definitely will. That's great. I'm glad that's your number one. So my number one will be a little bit of a surprise because the first time seeing this film, I loved it from the second I saw it.
Wow.
I've seen it many times since. And I champion this film all the time. It's criminally underseen and underappreciated, but it's Inside Llewyn Davis.
Wow.
Yeah. So Inside Llewyn Davis is the first film I saw with Oscar Isaac, where I was immediately sold on him being an A-list Hollywood star. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to see more stuff with this guy. This guy that had what seemed to be ambiguous ethnicity. He's Guatemalan, FYI.
He sure is. Yeah, he sure is.
But he also could play Middle Eastern in a film, and that'd be okay.
I'd buy it. I'd totally buy it.
He could be in the next Johnny Five Short Circuit film.
Italian. He can play Italian, I think.
He could play Italian for sure. He could be in a Godfather film. Absolutely. Yes. I wouldn't even question. So, but... For those who don't know, Inside Llewyn Davis is a film that is a week in the life of this aspiring folk artist, folk singer, musician. It takes place in 1960s, Greenwich Village, New York City. And this kind of this struggling musician that is really, for one, insanely talented. Two, is just can't catch a break. Three, is a major a-hole. And there's no reason this guy should have success by the way he treats people, his family, his loved ones. He's kind of a total jerk, but he's so good. And a co-star is Justin Timberlake. You've got is Carey Mulligan in
Carey
a role
Mulligan,
that
yep.
was the one blight, one blemish of this film is that not her performance necessarily, but I felt like she's kind of had one note. She was always angry, and that was it. It would have been nice for her character to have a little bit of an arc, but really this whole focus was, and maybe that's the way that Llewyn Davis perceived her to be, and maybe that's the way I can get around that performance.
Well, I think he was the reason for that, so.
No, absolutely. And he was the total thorn in her side, just constantly. But you've got... you've got this guy that's complete narcissist. It opens up with this. Now, this is, to me, it's almost an antithesis to Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, which is kind of interesting because this is my number one. Oh Brother, Where Art Thou is my number five, in the sense that inside this character of Llewyn Davis is really, really talented. And in fact, in one scene, he helps write and perform on the song, and he wants a quick payday, a quick cut. When the guy's like, well, we can cut you a check, but you know, you're not gonna be able to have the rights. You know, they're like essentially the royalties. I mean, if this song goes anywhere, and he doesn't care, he just needs a quick payday. And of course, that song becomes huge. And which is the opposite of what happens in Brother Where Art Thou, where, you know, the guy, it actually ends up paying dividends for them in the end, the fame and how big that record got. But for Llewyn Davis, it didn't. And that's to his own fault. He didn't deserve it. Where the guys in Brother Where Art Thou, you feel like they kind of do. But Llewyn Davis is this total narcissist. But the music in the film, also done by T-Bone Burnett, so again, frequent collaborator with the Coens, it is so good. I listen to the soundtrack all the time, which makes, I mean, that makes enjoying a movie, for me, it just heightens a movie tenfold. So when I watch it and I listen to these songs, and Oscar Isaac, he went to school at Juilliard's. So like, he's an actual, this is him playing, it's him singing. And the music is, the folk music is so good.
Who's on the soundtrack for that?
What's that?
Who's on the soundtrack for the movie?
Oscar Isaac, okay. And Justin Timberlake.
Yeah. Wow, they're good.
It's really good. It's really good. And so I love the fact it's them singing. It's not George Clooney singing in Oh Brother Where Art Thou, just FYI.
It should be. I wish that it were. Would that it were, but George Clooney singing.
Would that it were so simple. would that it were so simple. Oh, would that it were twer.
Why so are you simple. Doing that?
Why are you doing twer? Twer. Why do you do that? Anyway, I really, really love this film. It's not a happy film. It doesn't end with glory. You know, this, you know, spoiler alert, like, he doesn't get achieve fame or great success as far as we know. And he probably won't. You just get a snapshot, a week in this guy's life. You get a great John Goodman cameo when he's like, yeah. What kind of music do you play? And he's like, folk songs. He's like, I thought you said you were a musician. it's like, just classic John Goodman bits. It's a film that it's got this weird soft glow to it. The way they shot Greenwich Village, the 1960s, everything that's going on. Even though the film is a downer in the sense that this guy is kind of a jerk and he doesn't achieve success, the music is still really, really good. It's so well acted, and I love the slice of life. Just kind of, you get a snapshot of someone's week and seeing what it's like. It's endlessly fascinating to me. But the power of the music is probably the thing that really carries it for me. But like, it is such a good film. I really, really love Inside Llewyn Davis, and I can't believe it's not in your top five.
Yeah, so here, it's great that you have high praise for it, because I don't get it. I've seen it three times.
Really?
And yeah, it's all the things that you say, I understand. There's some really interesting parts, and but I love Oscar Isaac. He's one of the great actors working right now.
Yeah.
But for some reason, his character, I find just so abrasive and just so, I just can't root for him.
No.
So
no,
I see.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's such a jerk,
yeah.
And he is the cause of all this misery that surrounds him.
It's true.
And he's so oblivious. And I don't know if he's that talented, honestly.
Okay.
Like, I don't know that he's as good as he thinks he is. So maybe that's just, I don't know. It just doesn't resonate with me.
Really?
But it's a good movie. I mean, it's beautifully shot and well acted. I just don't, I don't know. For some reason, it doesn't suck me in.
So that's interesting. So there's this... the scene where he gets to Chicago to play for Les Grossman or whatever his name is.
Yeah.
and he plays this song called Queen Jane. And to me, I'm listening to that song blown away. And he finishes it. And I'm like, in my mind, I'm like, I want to sign this man to a major record deal. Right. Like, but I'm not a record executive, but F. Murray Abraham, great actor. He has this muted response. That's like, okay. And he essentially asks him, like, were you a part of a duo at one point? And he has to explain,
yeah.
Like, I had a partner, but he committed suicide. And then he says, like, oh, that makes sense. And it's like, oh. It's so weird to see F. Murray Abraham respond with so much apathy. Yeah. Now, is that how you responded? Were you not blown away with that song?
No, that's the one part where he really sounded awesome, okay, and I can't believe that he's this kind of tortured songwriter. But the opening scene, or it's not the opening scene, but the first time you see him perform in that bar or lounge or whatever it was.
Really? I didn't think it was that good. Song. Hang me.
Okay, yeah.
Oh, my God.
So I love folk music. I love that song. And I didn't think it was that good. So I couldn't suspend my disbelief.
Oh, this is great.
It's just something about it just doesn't.
Okay.
I don't know, man. He's just so acerbic. He's just so. Okay,
so
there's just
how about this? For those who have seen it,
I cannot root for him at all.
Or and if you haven't, go and see it. And hashtag inside Llewyn Davis or hashtag outside Llewyn Davis. I want to know your take.
I feel like that cat was right for running away from him. If I were that cat, I would totally run away from it at all costs.
I love the cat subplot. How could you not like that cat? It just wanted to get away.
Yes, exactly. So if we can just take a minute and get like academic about this, what does the cat mean to you? Like, what's the purpose of the cat?
I honestly didn't. I didn't ever interpret the cat from any academic standpoint. I mean, I guess you could, no, actually, I can't say I've ever really viewed it in any academic way, although I'm sure the Coens had intent for us to do that.
Right, exactly. And maybe that's the last piece of the puzzle that I need filled for me. Once I figure out what that cat means, then maybe I'll like it.
Yeah, I was about to give you some stupid response like running away from its problems, but really it's a cat, and what is it? Cat doesn't have any problems.
No, none at all. Except he's being cared for by just an irresponsible jerk.
Who just lets it run on the subway.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
But, I mean, just think about Llewyn Davis. Like, everyone that he meets or interacts with, he just uses them.
Yep.
Like, there is nothing.
Yep.
He doesn't give any part of himself to anybody. Yeah. Like, he is just so self-centered that,
Well, and maybe.
Although the scene where they're recording in the studio with Adam Driver and Timberlake, that scene's awesome. Like, that's a great scene.
The Please Mr. Kennedy song about the astronaut not wanting to go into space. Yeah. Oh. So
that's a great little scene.
That clip has gone viral on Facebook. That's like, hey, look at Poe Dameron and Kylo Ren with Justin Timberlake record a song, you know? Like, it's this thing, you know? And people are like, whoa, you know? But that song, though, is, like, really good. It really is.
So, yeah, other than that, man, I cannot get with Llewyn Davis. And, you know, building up to this movie, when I heard about it, when it was in, you know, like post-production or whatever, I mean, it was right up my alley. This is something that I'm super interested in, old folk music. I thought it was going to kind of be like a Bob Dylan type of story, but it's not. Like, maybe it is, but.
No, it's not.
Watching
Even though Bob
it,
Dylan's
I feel like,
in it, he was in the movie.
But, was he really? I didn't even know that.
The very end, you see this younger guy go up and perform, and it's Bob Dylan. He starts playing a song.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes.
So because it's supposed to take place in that same era, and maybe that juxtaposition or whatever is that Bob Dylan was someone you could root for, and it did have success.
Where
Oscar Isaac, no matter how talented he is, if you're a jerk and a narcissistic a-hole. Like, you get what's coming for you. And I know that doesn't sound like the most exciting premise to a film. Like, hey, really talented artist, but it doesn't matter how talented you are. If you're a jerk, you're not gonna be able to achieve success, which I don't know if that's really true.
The sad reality is a lot of artists are self-centered and
absolutely.
Jerks.
Absolutely. Yeah. Like, for example, Kanye West. Look, I just want the life of Pablo. I just want it released. Just can you not do a title exclusive, please?
Oh man.
Well, that's great. That was a good spirited conversation on Inside Llewyn Davis.
I'm really glad you picked that one as number one. So
yeah, well, I want to know what people think about it, because I haven't met a lot of people that are certainly not as bullish on it as I am. I want people to tweet us or email us their thoughts. Speaking of email, we got an email from someone that he started his email. He greeted us by calling us brave little leaders. It was like, I think it said, dear brave little leaders, which I thought was just the most lovely thing I've ever read. Oh, so great. It makes me feel like Kim Jong-il or Un.
Well, yeah, I mean, you have an army, so you have an army behind you of listeners. You are their general.
Well, in all seriousness, the people giving us feedback, tweet us not just if you liked Inside Llewyn Davis or Outside Llewyn Davis, but tweet us your top five Coen Brothers films. I want to know if Hudsucker Proxy or is it The Man Who Wasn't There or Raising Arizona or True
Blood
Grit
Simple,
or these ones
Raising
that
Arizona.
You know, definitely could justifiably be on someone's top five. Let us know what you think and why we're wrong. So.
So what were some of the other ones you considered for your top, your number five slot?
Yeah, so honestly, Raising Arizona and True Grit were just outside my top five. And I'm sure Miller's Crossing would have been, had I seen it more times than just the once leading up to this. The Man Who Wasn't There, okay. I liked quite a bit. Barton Fink, I liked quite a bit.
Okay. How did you feel about A Serious Man?
Oh, okay, yeah. I don't like A Serious Man.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's weird because I like it for all the reasons that I say I like Inside Llewyn Davis, except the guy doesn't play guitar and sing songs.
Well, that's a key component. So
yeah, yeah. I think it's too bleak.
It's very, very bleak.
Yeah, I think it was too bleak. I couldn't really. Some people claim to have loved it after watching it multiple times. What did you think?
I've seen it twice, and I liked it. I enjoyed it. I'd consider it for the number five, but you know, the more I thought about it, it's just I didn't love it, so yeah. I can't say that it belongs in the top five. I thought it was super interesting. Obviously, it's taken directly from the Bible, the story of Job.
Right.
But, yeah, I just thought it was really, really well made and just an interesting story all around. You know, looking at their list again, another one that I didn't understand at all was Burn After Reading.
Oh, okay.
I don't – I just could. It's a movie. I've only seen it once, so keep that in mind. But the one time that I watched it, I was just not engaged whatsoever. Didn't suck me in. Didn't really understand what I was watching.
Yeah.
And I wanted to love it because it had so many pieces that, you know, I love individually.
John Malkovich. But
yes, exactly. Malkovich, Brad Pitt, George Clooney, all these things. I should have loved it, but it just didn't work for me.
It had memorable scenes and moments, but the sum of his parts didn't totally work for me. Yeah. It was also a really bizarre follow-up to No Country for Old Men.
Yeah. Didn't you think so?
Yes.
I thought that was funny, too.
Yeah.
You know, and the Coens, one of the things that they're really just so good at is getting these great performances out of actors.
Yes.
You talk about John Goodman. Yeah. I mean, he's never better than when he's working with them. Oh, yeah, exactly. And John Turturro. Like, John Turturro, he's a fantastic actor. He's fine. But when he works with the Coens, like, it is another level. He becomes maybe the best actor of his generation.
Yeah.
But, you know, and with that in mind, I felt like they didn't use Brad Pitt well in Burn After Reading. I felt like maybe it was just his performance was off, but it just didn't connect for me. So,
well, it's left us with a great gif, and that's that one where Brad Pitt's pumping his hand, his fists in the air, and he's moving his shoulders and his elbows.
That'll be the legacy of that movie, without a doubt.
Also, a great death scene. And I guess I don't want to spoiler alert for those who haven't seen it. Yeah. Great death scene.
No spoilers. Oh, and just one last thing. Intolerable Cruelty is another one that, you know, I didn't hate it, but I didn't love it either. It's just kind of one of those. Kind of one of those ones that just it's watchable.
We worked at the movie theater when that came out, and I remember thinking, "This is a Coen Brothers film." Okay.
Yeah. There's nothing really Coen about it. You know.
No. It's my second. It's like Lady Killers is the worst. Next is Intolerable Cruelty. I certainly like Burn After Reading more than Intolerable Cruelty.
Yeah, I think you're right. That's a good call there. So
anyway, well,
I mean, it was fun to go back and watch all these movies, man. Some of them I haven't seen in a very long time.
Yeah, and there's some that I forget. There's like listening out their filmography, obviously with 17 films, but it's like, whoa, I forget how much they've done and how quickly they do them, and be able to do them at that level, in terms of craft and quality, consistently and frequently is really, really amazing.
It's almost impossible.
Totally.
To keep that level.
Totally.
I mean, their movies as a team, I mean, who's another brother act that can stick with them?
Well,
I mean,
besides the Wachowskis or.
The Fairleys.
The Fairleys, yeah. Yeah. I guess you said brothers and Wachowskis. That doesn't totally count anymore. But.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Can we just say siblings, I guess?
Yeah, that's fine. Fairly, yeah. Who else? There's got to. What's another?
What about the Nolan boys?
Oh, I guess that kind of counts. But Christopher Nolan gets a lot more credit than old Johnny.
Oh, yeah, he gets top billing. And I think his brother, the first thing that he wrote was Oh, I think his first writing credit, I think, was Memento, maybe?
Jonathan?
Or it could have been, yeah, I think that was his first writing
That's
credit.
That's right, yeah.
Off the top of my head. So, yeah.
Well,
I don't know, has he written anything without his brother?
He's helped on some of those DC films.
Some
of the Batman or Superman. I don't know, because I know Chris Nolan still is executive producer. I know Jonathan Nolan. I don't know if he has full writing credit, but I know that he helped in some ways. I was going to mention, though, the way the Directors Guild works, which is the stupidest thing in the world, but you can't have two directors listed unless it's become an established duo. And so for a while, Joel Cohen was getting the director credit, and Ethan had to be a producer, writer, editor, but couldn't be listed as director until they'd done like four
That's
or
insane.
Five films together, and it was established that they'd do this, and then it could be Joel and Ethan Cohen.
That's absolutely insane.
It's the dumbest thing ever. So dumb. Yeah.
So I have very little production in my background. Like, you know, I've been on very low budget self-finance stuff.
Sure.
But the things that are least successful universally, in my experience, are when you have multiple directors. So I've done it once. I mean, I've worked on a couple of things, one that did have two directors and then one where it was a director and a producer who felt like he should be director. And both of those things just didn't work.
Nope.
The final product was terrible.
Yeah.
So just in my meager experience, I can't really fathom how they do it as a team.
Oh, you have to have someone
to behold
with the singular vision and leadership and calling the shots for good or for better or for worse, right? For good or for bad. You've got to have that one person. And the amazing thing about the Coen brothers is I watch these interviews with actors who will claim that like they can ask Joel or Ethan a question knowing that they're going to get the same answer regardless, and that they're so consistent and so in sync and
right.
so in tune and
right.
That like it really is that consistent. There's not going to be a ton of disagreement or differing visions, which is really remarkable.
It's almost impossible. Like, just think about your own brothers.
Yeah.
How many times do you guys not see eye to eye on something?
Yeah.
So now try imagine doing a piece of art where everything is subjective.
Yep.
And now try to have a singular vision between the two or the three of you, actually.
Yeah.
So it's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, I totally agree.
I'd say.
Totally agree. That's a great point. But
I always bring up great points. So thank you for acknowledging that.
So I bring you here for the points, man. well, I think that sums up, I think, a nice Coen-y podcast. There's been a lot of good movies listed there. Really remarkable stuff. And ultimately, if you walk away with one thing, listen to this podcast, it's go see Hail Caesar. Let us know what you think.
Yes. Absolutely. You will enjoy it, I think.
I do. Yeah, I agree too. If you have the right expectations and the right mentality of what what type of film this is and what it's achieving, I really do think you'll enjoy it. And you know what? Regardless of that caveat, you're going to enjoy it. I think it's a fun movie.
Yes.
It really is.
Very much so.
So cool. Well, go see it. Let us know what you think. And thanks again, Aaron, for joining me.
Anytime.
And as we say,
hold on to your butts.
All right. See you, man.
Thank you for listening to the Brave Little Podcast. Hold on to your butts.